Probably a better way to problem. I'm whining today as I time 10 years ago, I didn't see the videos here. The present malaria is less than that. Finally, item 7 here deals with the brain drain, which is significant. The U.S. and Latin America is very dramatic. A couple years ago, when the total amount of money from the U.S. that was going to Latin America to support health development, and anyway, going to support medical food, going to support building of hospitals, immaterial of the source of the funds, the method of delivering funding through AID or other kinds of formats. The total value of the money that left here was equal to the 300 physicians that came here each year, not to train, but to stay here permanently. Especially two people come here for a couple years to train and go home. Some of those people came here permanently. It was about 300 a year. I'm not sure that today it's the same as 4 years ago, but still a high number. Okay. On to then the first page of this package. And this is my effort to express the relative importance of these different diseases in terms of mortality for the 16 diseases above the horizontal line here and morbidity diseases below. Each of these diseases has an impact in terms of morbidity and mortality. Each of them has prevalence and incidence. But my reason for leaving out the other data and going on this page is to simplify it, that you recognize that all 24 entities here have a prevalence, incidence, and mortality rate. This is deaths per year. And let me just review with you the meaning of prevalence and incidence. Who wants to approach that?
Yeah. Okay. Incidence, I think, is the So the number of cases at a given point in time, or let's see. The cumulative.
How many cases have occurred in whatever time period we define, a week, a month, a year? What prevalence is, what's going on at this time? Except that prevalence can be looked at as a period prevalence or a point prevalence. You could say, at this moment in time, how many people have colds in this room? Or you could say, in the past week or month, how many people have had colds? When you say it the latter way, it's almost approaching an incident statement, but nevertheless, the distinction is between, clear distinction between point prevalence, how many cases at this moment in time versus how many occurred in the past moment of time. Then there's another aspect to this, quite right to speak of absolute numbers and call them incidents of prevalence. Although it's real enough, you can say that for this country, there are X specific number of cases of new cases of tuberculosis. But both incidents of prevalence are meant to be rates, meant to be expressed as per unit of population. Again, the arbitrary what unit you want to use, but here they should be preferably expressed as rates. Okay, item number one, the antiretrovirals, estimated causes of death, 10 million. And obviously the impact there, mostly on children. Half of those deaths are in children under the age of 5. What is the cause of these kids? Is it the bacterial pathogens like typhoid or cholera? Is it amoebiasis, vascular dysentery? Well, cholera at its worst, and as you know, their waves have been the last 200 years, interesting charts of the movement of cholera in the place to place in the world, and it remains endemic in certain places like India, Indonesia. But in the worst years, during this century, no more than 500,000 people have been estimated to have died of cholera. Well, 500,000 cases of cholera don't explain but a 20th of the 10 million causes of death. I put cholera first because it has the greatest impact. Typhoid estimate is like 50,000. Amoebiasis, less than that. Vascular dysentery, less than that. Or if I can't account for more than, say, 1 million, 2 million, then what is going on with children? Well, you all probably know the new significance of the enteral pathogenic coliform. This, plus the new enteroviruses, the real viruses, dual viruses, we don't know in the latter just yet what their significance is and their impact. As far as the enteropathogens, we know a little bit more than we knew 10 years ago, 5 years ago. I forgot to bring in the paper that Fred Stark and I had published in JAMA a year ago. When the Vietnamese children came through here 2 years ago, Fred Stark from the Letterman and I, participated in the program of health care for children and an effort to appraise what kind of diseases or disease entities they were bringing in. Let me see if I can just roughly recall what happened. 50% of the children, 2/3 of the children were infants under 18 months. Of those, half had diarrhea. We isolated so-called heteropathogenic agents from, sorry, my question is a little bit unclear, but about 180 heteropathogenic E. coli organisms. But we only isolated 3 Shigella, no amoeba, and a couple salmonella. In other words, the children, about 400 children, from 400 children, we isolated 200 pathogens, of which Shigella, Salmonella, and only 5 of the children. The others were the so-called enteropathogenic organisms, as by the criteria, the old criteria of serologic typing. That criteria is almost certainly no longer valid. I'll put it this way. There are many types of salmonella. There are 800 salmonella. I guess there are about 200 to 300. Anybody know better than I? About 200-300 enteropathogenic serotypes. Is there a better figure than that? That just tells you how hard it is to run a longitudinal study on diarrheal diseases in the tropics if you're going to isolate coliforms, salmonella, and then go through the process of typing 800 and 200 respectively. Which is what you have to do if you're going to follow, if you're going to determine the impact of diarrhea on young children in the developing country, you get a cohort of 100 and then follow them during the course of the year with multiple stool examinations. That's why this process is so difficult. It's rarely been done. It's rather little data. Our kind of study here was dramatic, because it was traveler's diarrhea in reverse. I haven't said yet that among the volunteers, we had several hundred cases of diarrhea. And we isolated one Shigella and one Salmonella, plus 60 or 80 of these enteropathogenic coliform organisms from the volunteers and not from group control. So, no question that from the children, ultimately to the adults. What we are doing right now, Fred and I, we've just finished a project in which we took the same coliform organism and subjected it to the new testing procedure. Most of you probably know that coliforms now can be looked at as being enterotoxigenic or invasive. Some coliforms invade into the mucosa, as does Shigella type A. Some coliforms produce an enterotoxin that behaves like cholera enterotoxin, causes diarrhea, but is not invasive. A third characteristic of some of the coliform organism, of the enteropathogenic E. coli organism, is to be words used, to enter the small bowel. Normally, except for the lowest part of the small bowel is without organisms. But one mode of pathogenicity for the enteropathogenic coliforms is to invade the small bowel in the sense of going into the small bowel, as distinct from invasiveness, which is another characteristic, and third, as I said, the enterotoxigenicity. So, what Fred and I did, we took about two-thirds of the organisms isolated and subjected them to a variety of tests, adrenal cell tests, the rabbit ileo test, which are ways to check on these other, these nodes of new modes of pathogenicity. That's about where the field is at this time. You no longer use serologic testing as a criteria for pathogenicity. These new modes must must be used, and it'll take some years, possibly, to show the impact of coliforms and enteroviruses on this diarrheal syndrome. In the meantime, just raised an important question. What about being able to, say, protect these kids while you're waiting for specific measures to come along? Well, on the island of St. Lucia, a couple years ago, a friend of mine who became a health officer on the island for a two-year period did a very simple thing. He set up green hydration stations in a number of points, four or five sites around the island, and the death statistics from diarrhea in young children went from 150 per thousand per year down to 75 per thousand per year within months after starting the program. He took relatively untrained, unskilled women, showed him how to provide fluids, and that's all it took, just a rehydration station. If you added one more element to that, adequate nutrition, you would eliminate, I can't say where it would come down to, but come down to probably 25 or lower, 25, 35, 40 perhaps. So, it is feasible for all of you going out where we are to be highly effective by doing some simple things, such as setting up rehydration centers. And Dr. Devlin will be coming in during the third week here. Our pediatrician has had experience in the tropics. He'll give you his method of providing rehydration. I've got a couple of handouts showing Morley's method and another method. You should become keenly familiar with this method. It's one of the things in healing yourself. Okay, item two, malnutrition. Maybe it's first in importance in terms of mortality. It's hard to be sure, obviously, but it's significant in terms of interaction with all the other diseases of great importance. For example, cholera. It's rare for a healthy person in North America or Europe to develop cholera. That's why we abandoned the requirement for vaccination for cholera. Both because the cholera vaccine isn't terribly good, and secondly, people who are healthy usually don't come down with severe diarrhea. With severe cholera. Just one example of the interaction between infectious agents and state of nutrition. There are many other examples, and I'm sure we'll be speaking about this again if you go along talking about specifically schistosomiasis comes to mind. And I'll be elaborating this point. Let me just throw it out now. In Puerto Rico, basically, our dilemma in treating schistosomiasis is that the drugs that we have are not very good. And you're willing to accept a certain level of risk with the drug if the risk of the disease is very serious as well. But not long ago in Puerto Rico, the public health department decided that no longer would it be permissible to use the antimalarial drug for treatment of schistosomiasis. Why? Because the disease in Puerto Rico is no longer of great pathologic importance. The level of infection had not changed dramatically, even though they had a control program. The number of people infected, the prevalence rates and the incidence rates for schistosomiasis was about the same as it was 20 years ago, but the disease did not proceed to the advanced stage of liver cirrhosis, of bleeding from esophageal varices, etc. What had happened? The load of parasites the individual were carrying was down, and the nutrition was so much better. we know, although there's some proof for this as well, that good nutrition provides modest or excellent degree of protection for just as wise. Last comment, perhaps the nutrition of a very great interest now, is the interaction between nutrition, physical development, and particularly mental growth. It's obvious that state of nutrition relates to physical development. It's just so obvious in terms of stature and weight in many countries. Take Japan, where since the Second World War, there's been a constant decrease in stature and size. And when I was walking down the street in Japan, or walk down the street in Singapore, it's peculiar to feel almost like a giant walking down the street in Singapore, which is how I felt. I'm not particularly tall in this country, but I was ahead above most of the local people. When I went to Japan, just a year and a half ago, things were changing. I was high above most of the population, except for the young man. And everywhere there were young Japanese men whose heads came up to about 6 feet high. And you've read or heard about that. It's really quite true. They increased each generation. What's the latest theory on this? Is there anything better than the mother's pelvic bones being one of the limiting factors on the total size of the infant, plus the nutrition? Genetics aren't changing. But what's more important is the impact of nutrition on mental development. There's a lot of work going on in that area at the present time. And maybe Dr. Wilson can elaborate this more when she comes, because she's going to talk on it. Cardiovascular disease, we know, and the impact has been estimated at about 8 million per year. Tuberculosis, only in this instance, let me give you a prevalence and an incidence rate. Tuberculosis prevalence estimated at about 30 million people infected with TB worldwide at any one moment in time. And the new cases, the incidence is about 3 million per year. What I've just done is use the loose way of speaking here. I give you absolute numbers rather than cancer deaths per year, about 2 million. Pneumonia, 1 million. Malaria is now in the area of about 300,000. As you know, about 15 years ago, WHO had the hopes that they could eradicate malaria. At that time, 15 years ago when the program began, there were about 2 million deaths per year, mostly in children, some in adults, and now down to about 300,000. It's just holding at that level or increasing as there are breakouts in places like Ceylon and India. I'm going to quickly come back to speaking about Oaxaca State, Mexico, where I worked. Oaxaca is one of the southernmost states in Mexico. And many have been to Mexico City, very advanced society. They have the people competence and the hospitals and facilities equal to what we have here in most respects. But you can go backwards in time in Mexico by going to Oaxaca, leaving the road system and marching back into the mountains, and to go back 100 years in time. In the towns where I work, I've never seen a physician before. The deaths in children is in the range of half dying by the age of 5. Let me elaborate Oaxaca a little bit more in just a moment. But I was talking about malaria, and that's what started this out. Malaria, they've been spraying on the coast of Oaxaca for 15 years. And spraying has been very popular for removing trichoma bugs, which deliver shock disease. And so shock disease has stopped. They have not been successful for killing malaria. But when I go down there every summer, I always carry morphine with me. I'm always treating local people and Americans and come down to Florida, West Palmetto, Florida, even in Acapulco transmission malaria. It's really hard to control malaria, let alone eradicate it. That's why it hasn't yet worked. And probably can never work until we have vaccine. Accidents, one has to guess the role of accidents worldwide. I put it here in that position. Measles, this figure is too high now, but in fact, measles is still high. It must be 100 to 200,000. Only smallpox is making, only four smallpox are making a dramatic statement. That's going to disappear shortly. There still are a couple cases in Kenya. It's Ethiopia, I think you told me, Kenya. Dr. Roberto, one of the last people around here to see smallpox, worked with WHO and CDC. CDC is the Center for Disease Control. He is a member of the team in India when they finally controlled it there. He'll be coming in to talk to you this week on Friday. Smallpox will disappear in part because of what? I mean, obviously it's disappear because there's a good vaccine. That's it. There's no reservoir. Mechanism. Pardon? Supplemental cases are. But the reason it can be controlled is that there's permanent immunity. Most cases are controlled and they can be recognized. The vaccine is a superb vaccine, and we now know how to adequately protect it under proper conditions. The jet gun facilitates immunizing large numbers of people, and of course, of fundamental importance, man is the only reservoir mechanism. There's no wild animal law. By the way, what I didn't say this morning, I was trying to define tropical diseases. There's a great tendency here to include zoonoses in the tropical diseases, obviously, many of the tropical diseases have mechanisms involving insects and vertebrates.